You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extended version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, I'm talking to writer and artist Walter Simonson, who created a seminal run on the Marvel comic The Mighty Thor in the early 1980s, and saw the title restored to the mix of high action, strange juxtapositions of genre, and amazing artwork that first saw the hero in the spotlight when he was introduced to the Marvel Universe by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in the 1960s. Walt's run on Thor manages to be both traditional and experimental, and saw the creator come up with such intriguing ideas as giving the power of Thor to an alien warrior called Beta Ray Bill, and later turn the lead character into a talking frog. Both versions of the eponymous hero have turned up recently in Marvel Comics. First, though, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of checks, radio, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to writer and artist Walter Simonson. You've been working in the industry for about 35 years now, and yet your work seems to be as fresh as ever, and you're still working on classic heroes and sort of coming back to reoccurring themes. Do you find that when you come back to the same characters, you bring both the weight of experience and also some sort of enthusiasm to start all over again?
I really haven't gone back and revisited many of the old characters I used to do. I mean, really, I've kind of moved into different characters, whether it's at Marvel or whether it's at DC or doing work for Dark Horse or whatever it is. I generally haven't done characters and then gone back later. Mm. The only time I can think of where that really happened, you know, a long time ago, I did Thor for about a year in the late 70s, where I was doing layouts for Len Wein to do the script. I did the writing, actually. And then, of course, I went back to Thor about 4 or 5 years later in the early 80s, where I was writing it as well as drawing it. But that's about the only time I can think of where I really went back to a character I had really done for a while and kind of, you know, took a fresh look at it. But in general, I mean, I find that, you know, moving around from different characters is energizing. I've also taken some care, because I see it sometimes, and I mean, I saw when I was much younger, cartoonists have been in the business, you know, as long as I have now, where you could see they weren't really maybe doing the work quite as well as they had once done. So I've taken some care to do work where some work I write and draw, some work I write but have other artists draw, and some work I work with other writers and I get to draw it, because in the collaborative atmosphere of this kind of communal work, I find that, you know, if you get in sync with someone else, you end up creating something at the end that you wouldn't have done if you were just writing and drawing it yourself. And I find, so I write stuff I wouldn't have written otherwise, and I draw stuff I wouldn't have drawn otherwise, as well as the work I write and draw. So it's just a way of trying to keep the material fresh as you're, you know, kind of working on it. I took kind of a long view as I was working in comics. I really wanted to be able to do my best work as I went along, and so I've tried to do things where I don't feel I'm kind of going back over the same old ground again for one reason or another. The challenge of whatever I'm doing so far, I've been lucky, it's kind of remained fresh, and I think it's given me an impetus to try to do stuff maybe I haven't done quite the same way before. Did I answer your question?
Well, I mean, I suppose what I was kind of getting at is that, for example, if people go on Facebook, they can see you put sketches that you've only very recently done online, and you have feedback with your fans that is much more immediate than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. And so recent work that is available online that people can see are your drawings of, say, Batman and Manhunter. And those are characters that you started off drawing at the beginning of your career. So that there is a sort of cyclical nature of your work. But at the same time, obviously, you're bringing a new perspective to it.
Well, I mean, the Facebook thing is that's pretty recent. I've only been on Facebook for maybe about 6 weeks or so, and my wife dragged me onto it. But I've had a lot of fun putting up galleries. It's been tremendously enjoyable. Mostly, like the stuff that you're referring to, like the Manhunter Batman drawing that's up there right now, which I hope to finish tomorrow or the day after. I have gone back in the last year or maybe year and a half, maybe even 2 years, where I've gone back and I have revisited characters, I mean, like Thor and Beta Ray Bill, and now Manhunter and Batman, characters I once, you know, wrote or drew or both. Usually at the, it's generally in the aid of some sort of charity auction. You know, none of us getting younger, number of friends, I have older friends, and then some folks my age or younger who had health problems, for example, and so these are, you know, ways to raise a few bucks to help these guys out. But I find mostly there, I mean, in this case, for example, the Manhunter drawing, it's up there on Facebook right now. There's a, you know, it's Manhunter in the foreground, it's Batman and the Enforcer slash Dan Kingdom in the background. Well, there, I don't think I've drawn Dan Kingdom since the Manhunter strip wrapped up in 1974.
Right.
So it's not hard to, I mean, I don't feel like I'm going back over too much old ground there. Well, the ground is so old, it just seems new again.
Hmm.
So the biggest challenge in a way is trying to, in some ways, is trying to capture a likeness. I've had that problem with Manhunter before. I've done, like, covers for a couple of the reprints that we've done in the past. And I found I was having difficulty really capturing the likeness of the character I'd once drawn. In Manhunter's case, it turned out that after I'd been trying for a while and not really getting it, I realized that, particularly toward the end of the strip, when my style was really coalescing around the character, I'd been drawing him with an incredibly thin head. It's like his head was going to have a 2x4 on the narrow end. And I was drawing it more normally proportioned, and it wasn't coming out quite right. You know, the individual features were okay.
Mm.
So occasionally run into stuff like that where I think that my drawing is better now than it was 35 years ago. But there is a quality of the work that you do at any given time that identifies it and gives it its identity, really. And in going back and revisiting some of the old stuff, it's sometimes something of a challenge to find what it was that you were doing then to make the material seem like it's not just, you know, the work of an imposter or something where you're not quite capturing whatever it was you were able to do at the time, even if maybe your drawing wasn't as good. There's certainly youthful enthusiasm carries a great deal of weight, particularly in the early work of a lot of cartoonists.
Mm.
And so it's trying to find, with, in some ways, with more tools now, trying to find what it was I was doing back then with maybe fewer tools, but a great deal of enthusiasm, and that's kind of challenging. It's also not very fast. I was pretty slow when I was doing Manhunter back in the old days, and I find the drawing I'm doing right now, I'm still pretty slow trying to get a hold of it.
When you look at your own work, and then say perhaps other generations of artists that have followed you, do you see that there were sort of generational styles in comics? Because in the late 70s, you shared a studio with Howard Chaykin, Jim Starlin, and then eventually Frank Miller. And if you're to look for a common theme between all your work, it's some sort of combination of a heavily inked rectilinear style with a strong element of caricature.
Over the years, it's quite clear, and I speak right here of American mainstream comics, so that's really what I know.
Mm.
But it's quite clear that, you know, the styles of cartooning, the styles of drawing, the way people are represented in comics change over time. And that's been true since comics began. And in the mid-60s, or early to mid-60s, I think Jack Kirby really remade the way in which superheroes were done. And the work that was being done after that for many years was work that was clearly either pre-Jack Kirby or post-Jack Kirby. But Jack was a huge watershed for style and for an approach to superheroes that kind of remade the business visually, and I think to some extent because of it, remade the business as business. Since then, I mean, we've come far enough now from that other styles have come in, and there's kind of a wide variety now. Of course, there are a lot more books as well, and there are a lot of books that aren't, you know, American mainstream superheroes. There are a lot of comics, and so there's a huge range of approaches to graphic storytelling. I look at a lot of them. I mean, I'm still very grounded in American mainstream stuff, but my work's always been somewhat eclectic. I've always borrowed heavily from European sources.
Mm.
I'm a big Otomo fan. Topi in Italy and Palacios in Spain, Mobius in Mazier in France, Jim Holdaway, Frank Bellamy in England, have all been major influences on my work over time, and in most cases going back a long time. So that I've trained, of course, in Kirby and Ditko and other people here in America. But I can see stuff changing with time. But I don't know that I've gone to modern guys to recreate my own work. But I've certainly looked at stuff as it's gone by, and I've tried to work as hard as I could to, even though the work always looks like me, I would like it to still feel as though it's fresh when I'm laying it down. I go to a good deal of trouble to try and make that happen.
Hmm.
So I'm not exactly bound by the styles as they're going by, but I'm aware of a lot of the stuff, and I incorporate some of that stuff as I go along. I mean, one of the things that's happened, for example, in the last, 10 years, say, image and pre-image, a lot more lines per square inch for a while. And this is in one particular approach. And if you go back and look at the Orion work I was doing, which is, you know, much, 15 years after Thor, maybe something like that, the drawing in Thor is much simpler. The outlining, the rendering, all that stuff is way simpler in Thor. There's a lot more work in sort of lines for Squinch and Orion, which is really responsive to what was going on in comics visually. And really, of course, you know, as you get older as an artist, you're supposed to get simpler. Apparently I failed to learn that lesson.
Your run on Thor, because it is one of the comics that you're best remembered for. From the start, you were writing it as well as drawing it. So when you were approached to do the comic, had you various themes that you wanted to start incorporating from the start? Because, for example, the idea of incorporating space opera into Thor isn't something that maybe a lot of people would have thought about, but it's something that you did very well right from the off.
Well, a couple of things there, really. One of them was, when I was in college and then for some years thereafter, which means, you know, late teenagehood, early 20s, mid-20s, even a little bit later than that, I was a big reader of science fiction. Read a lot of science fiction and fantasy. I was both. I was a big Tolkien fan. I read Moorcock. I read, you know, Heinlein. I read Asimov, Brian Aldiss. I really kind of covered the waterfront at a time when, you know, you probably could read a lot of most of the important science fiction authors in a reasonable time. Now, I mean, the field exploded eventually about that time, late 60s. I'm not sure it'd be possible now, but I read a lot of stuff at the time. And along with that, I was a huge, I read Marvel Comics in the mid to late 60s. That's when I first discovered them. I read them rather religiously for about 5 or 6 years, you know, bought everything they put out, which, you know, back then was 11 titles, so you could actually afford to do it. And Thor was my favorite of the comics Marvel put out. I was Thor, Iron Man, Spider-Man, and the Fantastic Four were probably my major four, but although I read everything. Well, Thor, if you go back and read the Lee Kirby Thors, they are a very interesting mixture of mythological stories and science fiction stories. I say science fiction as in pulp science fiction, which is what I was doing.
Mm.
You have the colonizers of Rigel, Ego, the living planet. I mean, Galactus makes an appearance, even though he was created in the Fantastic Four, he makes an appearance in Thor. They really, High Evolutionary, the Beast Men, I thought they did a great job of combining these two very disparate elements, sort of the science fiction looking forward, mythology looking backwards, and it created an interesting tension and a lot of fun. It was fun to see a Norse god, you know, riding on spaceships out across the galaxy with all these, you know, aliens and everything else, as well as the mythological stories that they did with Asgard and Odin and Baldur and his pals back home. So when I was doing the book, when I began doing it, I really had that in mind. I that was, in a sense, what I was trying to do was recreate what Stan and Jack had done, the stuff that I had enjoyed, without just doing Stan and Jack stories. I had no interest in going back and retelling the stories they had already told, but what I wanted to try and do was capture, in a sense, the flavor of what they had done without being slavishly imitative of that flavor, if that makes any sense.
Mm.
And so that was a mixture of Norse mythology. I'd been a big mythology fan, Norse particularly, but I read a lot of mythology. I liked mythology a lot. And I'd read that from a pretty early age, so I knew a lot of that stuff going into the comic. I liked it when it was in the comic when Stan and Jack did it. I did not want to make the comic just a recapitulation of the actual myth.
Hmm.
The thing about that is that, you know, you can buy a book in a bookstore, any one of dozens of books, read the myth. There's no reason to buy the comic just to read the myth. And so what I wanted to do was use the myth as a basis for the stories in Thor, or as one of the bases for the stories in Thor, but not just go back and try to do them over again, because you could get them elsewhere. I also felt it wasn't really incumbent upon me to go back and, you know, turn Thor's hair red. I did give him a beard. I debated about turning his hair red at one point, you know, because, of course, it's a comic. He could step into a nuclear furnace somewhere and come out with red hair or whatever you wanted to do. We'll warp into a dimension, come back, his hair has turned some other color. But I felt if I did that, then it would really alter the costume. You'd have red hair and then a red cape. So you've got to change the cape color, because this is in the days when there only were about 35 or 40 effective colors in comics. Now that wouldn't be true. But there were enough changes that would have to be made, I decided to abandon that. But I gave him the beard anyway, because that was just fun. So I brought in mythological elements, a lot more from the actual stories, without trying, just again, to tell the actual myth stories. And I brought in a lot of science fiction, because I felt it was a nice mix for that. It created a certain tension with the character. I thought that it gave him both sort of one foot in the past, one foot in the future. Mm. And I liked that a lot with the character.
Well, I suppose it's inevitable in a way when you're retelling stories that are based on old mythologies, they're going to be somewhat influenced by the period that they're being told on, being told in. And so if there's a lot of sci-fi in the zeitgeist, the retelling will reflect the concerns of the time.
It does. I mean, it just, you know, it seemed like an okay mix. And I didn't stick strictly to the Norse mythology.
Mm.
When I was doing, I did one story in, Thor 355, where he met his great-grandfather, who is in Norse myth, you know, the original god, the first god, Buri. But I wanted to do it in a way that Thor wouldn't recognize his great-grandfather. He'd never met him before. He had when he was a baby, I said, but he'd never actually seen him as an adult. And Buri had really retired. He'd been a god a long time and kind of given the job up and gone off in the wilderness where the world was kind of wild and free in the way that it would have been, I thought, when he was born. And the stuff he remembered, kind of he'd gone home again and stayed there. But I didn't want to call him Buri because I didn't want people to know, you know, who he was to start with. So I took a name from an old Germanic sky god, Tiwaz, T-I-W-A-Z, who's not so well known, about which not very much is known. But it was a name that had antecedents in Northern European Germanic mythology, so it seemed like an appropriate name, and it was one that wasn't so well known. I didn't think my readers would instantly leap to the idea of who this character really was. They'd find out what was everybody else at the end. So I did stuff, I borrowed stuff from the English, the Celtic fairy faith, actually in England,
mm-hmm.
where I did the Dark Elves, and the Dark Elves have antecedents, of course, in the in Norse myth, but I borrowed a lot of stuff that they did, the stuff with the fairy food. Some of that stuff came out of fairy tales that were told, and beliefs that were held of the fairy folk, the people of peace, as they were called. So I used some of that stuff. I took stuff in a way almost like a survey where I felt it would further the stories I wanted to tell. And at bottom, the only thing I guess I could add is that the basic idea for my first year and a half of Thor, I guess, when I began writing it, was really an idea I had with Surtur and the Great Sword and the destruction of the Rainbow Bridge and a lot of that stuff, really were ideas I'd had when I was back in college, when I was really reading Thor and just entranced by getting it every month and enjoying the stories. And after I knew enough about the book and had learned enough about the character over time, you know, I began thinking about my own stories, about what I would do. And I mean, not with an eye toward getting into comics at the time. It was the furthest thing from my mind, but it was something, you know, just I like telling stories. And so I put together some ideas which in kind of vastly altered form, with some striking similarities, became the Surtur Saga, which was really the first big story arc that I told when I was doing the book.
Mm. Well, and even the look of new characters like Beta Ray Bill seems to be influenced by older mythologies. His sort of horse skull-like face seems to invoke the thoughts of maybe Egyptian gods or Celtic gods.
Well, I hadn't thought of it. I mean, the thing is, of course, you do work. You give birth to work, you let it grow, you send it out into the world, and people find what they find in it. It's not always what you thought was there.
Mm.
In the case of Bill, I've said this elsewhere, but the character look was really, well, maybe about three things went into it. One was the costume that was, you know, very Thor-like, because he got Thor's power, was really because back in those days, American comics were really a short form. People were not reprinting work. It wasn't like we knew we were going to have six-issue story arcs coming out as trade paperbacks down the road. The books came out. They were gone.
Mm.
I mean, comics, you know, when I was first doing this, 83, 84, there were some comic shops and there were places you could buy back issues, but it wasn't a major market at the time, certainly not for the companies anyway. So comics were kind of a short form. American superhero comics were a short form. And as a result, you used a lot of symbols for meaning as a shortcut to meaning, really, in the things that you were doing. So when I gave Bill that costume, it wasn't so much that the Don Blake's walking stick, which converts into a hammer when you struck it, it wasn't so much that his walking stick was actually its own personal tailor, but it was that when he struck the stick and it turned into a hammer, and he turned into Beta Ray Bill, by giving him that outfit, I did not have to spend any time explaining what had just happened.
Mm.
The second it happened, the second he had the hammer, the second his costume changed into what it became, which is kind of a mixture of Thor's costume and the armor he wore, or, you know, a variation of the armor he was wearing before he became Bill. Before he became Thor, Beta Ray Thor, was not specifically from the armor, but it was the same general design sense. So that was an instant meaning, an instant glyph for meaning anybody would follow into the book. As far as Bill's face was concerned, I wanted two things out of that. One is I wanted a sense of beauty, and the other is I wanted the monstrous. Because, again, as a shortcut to meaning, back in those days, mostly bad guys looked dreadful and good guys looked handsome. And then you knew who the various players were. Of course, all that meant was that, you know, bad guys were monstrous and bad girls just wore less clothing. So in Bill's case, I wanted to look monstrous because that way, even though readers would know what the inscription the hammer was, which was, "Whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor," they would know that. And of course it says, "if he be worthy."
Mm.
And I wanted to both mislead the readers and yet be perfectly straight with them. So by making Bill monstrous, when he hits the stick, turns into the hammer, becomes Beta Ray Thor, I had very few readers. I don't think I had any readers that wrote me letters and said, "Oh yeah, well this guy's really just a good guy. I could see this coming a mile away." After I did that story, I had a lot of readers say, "Oh yeah, I knew this was happening." But at the time I did it, nobody knew it was happening.
Mm.
They all said, "Oh my gosh, it's a monster. How can this evil guy pick up the hammer?" And on the other side of it, because I used, roughly a horse's skull. I didn't sit down with a horse's skull and look at it. I knew what they looked like, roughly. I was a paleontologist, geology major back when I was in college, so I
did
a lot of that stuff. But horses are just beautiful. So actual horses are just beautiful animals. And so that's why I chose that particular skull. Not so much because I think people would look at it and go, "Wow, how beautiful it is," but the skull beneath the skin, the beauty that goes beneath that structure, within that structure. And so I just thought that was a way of getting a couple different meanings, even if I did not expect readers to look at it. Again, I've seen people make, disparaging remarks now about the horse-faced alien. And yet, before I told people this story about where the skull came from, what the design was, I never saw anybody, and I mean anybody, say, "Oh yeah, it was from a horse's skull." I've seen people say that since, "Oh yeah, I know it was from a horse's skull." I never heard from anyone before I told the story that it was a horse's skull.
Mm.
So, but that's really why it developed that way. That's why, a lot of thought went into how I was going to design the character so that the kind of the layers of meaning that character represented for me and for the story would really be built in to the structure of the character visually. And that's how it came about.
Do you find it surprising that this many years after your run, that not only are there collected editions that are sort of revered in being some sort of seminal run on the comic, but also your versions of the characters keep coming back? Beta Ray Bill has appeared in various space comics. Even your frog version of Thor is about to appear again in a comic.
Well, it's very flattering. I'm especially amused about the frog, to be honest, but you create stuff in comics. The Thors that I did sort of seem to exist almost in a vacuum because they certainly were well thought of. I'm very pleased about that. But they didn't, at the time, didn't have a long-term effect on the character, other than the time, the 3.5 years I was doing the character, because, after I got off the book, Tom DeFalco and Ron and Friends got on, and, Tom is very much a fan of the older material, and he kind of went back to a lot of that stuff, and so it kind of made the work I did exist almost in like a bubble. But it's very nice that, the stuff has an extra life, and that, that people thought highly enough of it to want to go back and redo the stuff, or at least do it in some new form. I mean, I understand that completely. After all, most of my career, much of it has been doing work on characters other people created, and I don't get on there to try and remake the characters or to change them radically, but I also don't get on there to go back and just tell the same stories people once told. I just find I like the characters. I'm excited about the world in which they live, the structure of the world around them, and I try to find ways to tell stories about those characters in that world that maybe haven't been told before. That's really virtually all the books I've gotten onto, all the mainstream books I've gotten to with regular characters like the Fantastic Four or Thor or Wonder Woman. I've gone back and tried to find some kind of story that feels like it's not just a story you've read before.
Mm. Well, when it came to doing the comics with the Frog Thor in them, as a reader, it seems as much that it gives you an opportunity to do some beautiful rendering of animals as well, which you clearly enjoy doing.
Well, I did. I mean, I got to draw stuff I hadn't drawn before, and that's certainly true. I like doing that. Actually, the genesis of the story was really that when I'm doing a regular comic long term, like a monthly book, like Thor or the Fantastic Four or Orion, as you're doing it and you're thinking of ideas and you're writing up your stories, you're always finding other ideas. Other ideas occur to you. You go, oh, this would be kind of a cool idea, and you write that down. I write down notes because I never remember the stuff. I just have to write my notes or I forget them. And I write down, I keep an idea file of possible stories. And usually by the time I quit doing the book, I have more story ideas left that I haven't explored than the ones I've actually done in the comic book. That's been true for most of the books that I've worked on. So in the case of the Thor Frog, that really began as a single sentence in my idea file. I kind of keep a list of them, like almost like a numerical list.
Hmm.
And that was to do a tip of the hat to Carl Barks. I'm a huge Carl Barks fan. Carl Barks is the artist who wrote and drew the Donald Duck story in Walt Disney Comics and Stories for 20-plus years. He invented Uncle Scrooge, did a quarterly Uncle Scrooge comic for a number of years, invented Gladstone Gander, invented Gyro Gearloose, a lot of the characters associated with the Donald Duck comics, and eventually some of them made it to cartoons. And he remains one of my favorite writer-artists ever to do comic books. So I had an idea of doing a tip of the hat to Carl Barks. And in some way, and I don't remember how this actually worked out, I got to a point in the Thor stories where I suddenly thought, oh, you know, I could do kind of my tip of the hat to Carl Barks. And I guess I had Loki involved, and I was thinking about transformations, and at some point that suddenly clicked, and it clicked really at the right time. So, you know, I think at the time I considered it, and I thought, I could make Thor a duck. But really, when I thought about it, and I was borrowing so much and using so much of the influence from fairy tales and legends and myths and all that kind of stuff. We know mostly when the handsome prince gets enchanted and turned into an animal, it's often a frog. Not every time, but it's a frog a lot of the time. And so I thought, well, instead of doing a duck, I'll do a frog. That seems more appropriate for the background, really, from the character, from the myths and legends and fairy tales and all this I've been using as background for what I was writing. And I got that far. I was living in New York City at the time. I was living on the West Side. I wasn't too far from the reservoir. I was south of the reservoir, but not too far from it. And the reservoir was a running track for, you know, for everybody who lived there. I'm sure it still is. And so I began thinking about it. And numerous elements. And every so often, you get articles in the news where the city would be laying down rat poison in the parks to try and reduce the rat population and stuff of that sort. So all these things kind of came together to be part of that story over two issues of just Thor as a regular frog, more or less, and then one issue of him as a Thor frog. And in doing that, I got to do a story about kind of the rat-frog war, which was really a sort of a parody, or maybe a satire, of my own stuff and of any kind of great adventure story where you have, you know, the hero going out against insurmountable odds and, you know, maybe wooing the princess, and he didn't quite woo the princess, but she fell in love with him anyway. So it was really, it was both a tip of the hat and a parody, the kind of epic storytelling, but and maybe a little bit of Aristophanes as well with the frogs and the birds, other birds in this one, but, you know, stories through animals. And I thought in the end it actually worked out very well. That was the one story that I did where I got a fair amount of ambivalent mail. I didn't get a lot of angry mail about it. I got very few negative letters. I used to write the letter columns in the book, in the editorial voice. I didn't usually use my own voice very often. And so I read all the mail that came in. I chose letters. I wrote the answers. I usually try to run about one unhappy letter per column, one from some fan who was crabby about something, and then answer them, you know, as reasonable fashion as I could. But it would give, if you use that as your sample, it would give a misleading sample, because that'll say four letters, one letter's crabby, and three of them are you know, praising you. I did not get 25% unhappy letters. I was way, way smaller than that. But often the unhappy letters were the ones that were smart. They had thought about things. They didn't like stuff for some particular reason. And it gave you a chance to jump off and talk about kind of what you were doing in the comic and why you were doing it. So in the frog story, about my mail ran about half and half. And it wasn't half good and half bad. It was half good and half kind of puzzled about what I was just... Is this supposed to be funny? Am I supposed to laugh at the idea? They weren't quite sure what to make of it. And now, like a gazillion years later, probably the two stories I hear most about are the Beta Ray Bill story and the Frog story. And they kind of run neck and neck. I mean, Bill's kind of come back as a character recently, so there was a while I was hearing more about the Frog story. Now I still hear more about Bill again. But that's really where the idea came from. It came from, I wanted to tip my hat to Karl Barks, whose work I was a huge admirer of. And I reached a point in the comic where I thought that would be possible. And I got to combine some urban myths by putting in the crocodiles in the sewers of New York and some stuff like that seemed like a natural fit for the story.
Thank you very much. That was brilliant.
You're quite welcome. Take care.
You too.
Coming up in future editions of Panel Borders are my interviews with Alex Irving and Alex Maleev about Daredevil, and Leah Moore and John Repian about Doctor Who. For more info about those, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.